Welcome to the Unfiltered Podcast with me, Joe Warner, and powered by Ultimate Performance, the world's premier personal training experience that delivers maximum results in minimum time. In each episode of the Unfiltered Podcast, I interview the most respected, celebrated, and controversial experts in the fields of health, fitness, nutrition, well-being, and performance to help you find the life-changing advice you need to live smarter. Remember, you can find all of our exclusive Unfiltered documentaries, video interviews, and investigations at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. And now, on with the show. Victoria, it's so great to speak to you, and there's a ton of things I want to cover, but I'd love to start with the Enhanced Games because it's got a lot of publicity, both in the UK and the US and North America recently, for the creation of a non-drugs tested sporting contest. Now, I know we can't necessarily talk about specifics here, but would you be able to give us kind of a broad stroke overview of doping in sport and why this has garnered so much interest right now?
Doping in sport, it's a complex topic, to be honest, because there are so many varied opinions right now in kind of the popular discourse, whether we're talking about in the media, within different levels of organized sport, whether we're, you know, elite all the way down to national or even like collegiate, even lower than that, I think just recreational sports. So there's so many different opinions circulating right now about it. But the reality is that doping, the act of using a substance to help augment performance, is a historic thing. So there are, you know, some really great historians in this world that look at it and have traced it all the way back to like the ancient kind of Olympic endeavors where they would use all these different concoctions of things.
Was this like about bulls' testicles and stuff? We're like in the
that was actually, yeah, that was actually more forward in time, believe it or not. Back then there were things like, I mean, gosh, I've seen stories of them using like bee stings. I've seen stories of different types of like tinctures and kind of on all accounts today would be like, oh, it's just like potions, like a bunch of herbs crushed up. But they perceive them there to be some form of performance enhancement effects, and therefore they use them. Now, fast forward to the turn of the century, the last century, not the current one. But that is when like the modern Olympics, or the modern mega Olympic sporting events, really was birthed. And there was a lot of strong ideas and opinions about what was right and wrong to do in sport, who was allowed to participate, who wasn't, under what circumstances. So there was these ideologies, these philosophies that came alongside the modern Olympic sporting movement. Now, back then, they really did not care about drugs. That's something that a lot of people don't recognize, is that when the Olympics first started, there was no such thing as doping or drug testing movements, or what an enhanced athlete was versus a natural athlete. That wasn't even in the vernacular at all. What the main motive was how can we promote individuals being the best athletes possible under any circumstances? And, you know, again, I can go into the philosophy and the history of this, but that was a lot of kind of ideas in the social consciousness of the time of like, it's like, what can we do with man and woman? What can we do with them? How can we see them run the fastest? What is that going to take? And so that's kind of the birth of sport, is that it was about in competitive sport, elite competitive sport. It was like, let's see what we can do. Let's see who can be, you know, the strongest, the fastest, the best athlete possible. Into the 1920s, the discourse changed a little bit. Now, there was kind of murmurs around drug testing even back then, but it wasn't like what it is today. And a lot of the drug testing discourse was actually around horse racing. It wasn't around human consumption of drugs. It was around the doping of animals for sport, dog racing, horse racing, and that was unethical because you're giving these poor animals all these different concoctions to either, and it was actually not to make them perform better, it was to make them perform worse. It was to actually get them to slow down so that you could win bets. So it was really tangled into gambling, and so totally different ideas to what it is now. In the 1920s, though, there were start to be some discussions around athlete health, because elite sport was growing bigger at the time. Athletes were, you know, there's some questionable practices coming about what was right or wrong to do in sport, who was allowed to participate versus not. Back then it was, competitive sport was a elitist thing. I would argue it still is today, but it was upper class, wealthy, especially gentlemen. You could not be a worker. You had to be literally unemployed to be able to participate in elite sport. So a lot of the ideas that actually came up was that the ethics of sport and the ethics of what was right or wrong was more based around that rather than drugs. Drugs just kind of got tangled up into the 1920s, into the 1930s, and then moving forward to where we get to in the 1960s, which was the former implementation of drug testing policies, not only at the Olympic level, but at other elite levels of sport. And they decided to carve out some really strict rules around the substances that were allowed or not allowed, regardless of what scientific evidence said. So this is a big thing that has always challenged me as a researcher, is how do we decide what compounds are right or wrong, good or bad, healthy or unhealthy, risky, dangerous, performance? How do we actually decide that? And a lot of the current research is starting to suggest that maybe some claims are made around certain substances within that kind of performance enhancing world that weren't actually rooted in scientific evidence, that were more rooted in ideas and assumptions, and that the effects of performance are kind of overstated in drug testing policies and just discourse. And that's what I find really interesting about when we think about what substances athletes today in sport are allowed to use or not allowed to use. Like, what is considered to be doping? What is considered to be artificial enhancement? That those are really some basic belief systems that have been attached to a substance. That's really what it comes down to, is that if we give an example of, let's say, what's a good example? I mean, testosterone. It's the most probably politicized example I can take, but so testosterone, it was never an issue within sport. It was never considered to be a bad thing for athletes to use up until about the 1950s, 1960s. And even then, there were a lot of debates about whether or not this drug actually could increase performance. And now I understand that some people listening to this are probably like, oh my gosh, is she mad? Like, of course it impacts performance. But the reality was, back then, they didn't know. They didn't have like absolutely bulletproof empirical scientific evidence to show whether or not this drug enhanced performance, because they were also using it in health settings. And so people were saying, again, I've done a lot of work in this world, that like, how can we have a drug that's being used in healthcare to support health and anemia, for example, or muscle wasting disorders, but then all of a sudden it's got magical, mythical properties when used by an athlete? So there was a lot of discussion about that. Ultimately, they decided that no, anabolics are bad. And, you know, here we are today, where they're still considered to be restricted in sport under, I would say, 99% of circumstances. Trans athletes have started to open the conversation around what some of these substances mean, but for the most part, these drugs are still completely off limit for individuals to use, male, woman, even if there's a medical circumstance that necessitates the need, because the sporting authorities have said, hey, no, it's got too much performance enhancement and too much health risk behind it. In today's kind of governance of drugs and sport, there's three main things that are used to decide whether or not a drug is doping or against kind of the ethos of sport, and that those three criteria are really ambiguous. We could have that conversation around even technologies that people use, like is that certain type of fast track, like speed skating, is that performance enhancement based off the rules? We can apply this kind of metric to a whole bunch of different substances, but ultimately, you know, the powers that be make these decisions. And if you want to play their game, literally, if you want to play their game, you need to follow their rules. Whether or not we think it's right or wrong, that's the world of modern sport as we know it.
So are those criteria, the two you mentioned in terms of performance enhancing drugs being too effective and too dangerous, Is that right? Or is this a fundamental misunderstanding that you would love to see looked at, changed, you know, thrown out the window? Because I think a lot of people just get caught up in kind of what they're told. Drugs are bad, performance enhancing drugs are unfair, and base their decision on this legacy of information, which I don't know. Is it correct?
Yeah. So there's the three criteria, is, and it has to be two out of the three. So one, does it enhance performance? Two, is it risky or dangerous to the athlete? Three, is it against the ethos of sport? Like, does it go against this? And that's a hard thing to define. Like, does it go against the spirit of sport?
Because the two, I guess you could agree on criteria, because there is then testing or biomarkers or whatever. But the third, I mean, is a purely subjective element, isn't it?
Yeah, and I would argue that the first two are actually a lot more complicated than we believe them to be, that there's a lot of nuances involved, because what may be dangerous for one individual may not have the same inherent risks as the other. Devil's in the dose and the duration of use a lot of times. And so, you know, there are certain substances that to this day are still restricted in sport that they're being used in medicine without much discussion around their dangers. Corticosteroids, for example, let's say for asthmas, that there's not that same discussion around it, but in sport, lots of regulations. And so whether a drug is performance enhancing or not, whether it is risky for athlete health or not, is quite nuanced. It's quite complicated. It's definitely not as linear as especially like the anti-doping kind of powers that be have made it out to be. And also some of the research that does exist, if you really carefully look at it, you just see this game of almost like telephone, where an initial study was done maybe in the 1930s or 1940s, not with the same rigors that we have today. And a finding was constructed, and then somebody repeated that one, and then somebody repeated that one, and then somebody repeated that one. And then all of a sudden you have people building modern research studies off of this finding that isn't actually really good, but there's kind of like this fallacy that exists where they then just start looking for the potential for this drug to be either a health inhibiting or performance enhancing.
So coming back to the enhanced games, and again, speaking kind of hypothetically, not going too much into what they're proposing, but the outline is there won't be any drugs testing, but obviously the athletes will be monitored very, very closely. The main pushback seems to be, I guess, athlete safety, the ethical considerations, and I guess almost a fear of opening a Pandora's box, that if this succeeds, what next? Where does it end? In your professional view, are any of these concerns warranted, or is it just too difficult to say athlete safety will be compromised because we're all unique specimens?
And not just that, we're not just unique specimens, but high-performance athletes are mutants. There's a reason why they're there and we're not. At the end of the day, there has been some studies that have looked at certain biomarkers, even like genetic or epigenetic kind of traits that exist within that elite athlete population. There's this one paper that I love that talks about how, like, especially within the elite female population, is what the scholar was speaking to, how you shouldn't look for this like statistical norm, this p-value of sorts, because you're never going to find it. It doesn't exist, because these people are so unique. And what makes for a good athlete is far beyond just like a single gene or a single blood marker or a single set of biomarkers. That it's a lot more complicated than that. There are biological factors, there are social factors, there are environmental factors that really are encompassing an individual from before they're born until where they are today. So this idea that there's just this like linear ability to say whether or not a drug is going to be inherently good or bad or healthy or risky or whatever, it's just far too complicated. I jokingly say this, but I honestly do mean it with I don't even know how to phrase it. I just really believe it to be true, is that human beings are the worst research subjects. That we think that we can control a ton of different variables and be able to tell whether or not like X equals Y or A plus B equals C. But there are so many variables involved that it is incredibly difficult to say that. So while I would love to believe that, you know, by looking at athlete health and really focusing on that, I love that idea. There's risk involved with everything and anything, that it really comes down to how can we manage and mitigate the risks where possible. I love that philosophy and that stance, but there is still going to be inherent risk involved. I mean, just even participating in sport, you open yourself up, depending on the sport, to certain risks. Look at long distance running, or you know, 2010. So I was in Vancouver at the I used to work at Vancouver, at the university there. But when the Winter Games are going on there, you know, I was very much involved in looking at just the different sports involved and everything else, and then kind of followed that up until when I left the university in 2018. But one of the things you start to see is that there have been athlete deaths just from the sport itself. So in skeleton, for example, there was an example of an individual that died because the track itself, his apparatus, something happened, and you know, he passed away very, very sadly. And but it does illuminate the fact that yes, risk is involved. Whether or not we have drugs, risk is involved. So drugs are there, athletes use them, and I can tell you that athletes use them, you know, depending on what we're actually talking about, even within tested organizations, because it's just not concrete. It's not that easy. There are therapeutic use exemptions which can allow certain substances that are prohibited under certain circumstances to no longer be prohibited for that individual. There are certain substances that may be prohibited in competition, but they're not prohibited out of competition settings. It's just not this black and white picture that people make it out to be. And I think what concerns me about this kind of new mission we're on with this organization is that it is kind of still creating this myopic box around drugs as being good or bad, right or wrong, healthy or risky. And it's just, I just have a little bit of warning caveat that it's more complicated than that.
So $1 million question.
Yeah.
Should this be allowed? You know so much about mm-hmm. this world, performance enhancing yeah. drugs at elite level in both men and women. What is this, a head versus heart? Do you want to see it to allow athletes to have the best chance of fulfilling their potential above? Mm-hmm. Or would you always shy away from it because you know so much and you know what the inherent risks are? Again, I know it's an incredibly complex and difficult question, but if a gun was against your head, which way would you go?
I'm neutral. that's the thing, is I'm neutral because I feel like within tested organizations, there are a lot of challenges that arise. You know, I work with and I consult with different elite athletes, different elite organizations, even those that are doing drug testing. One of the big questions that comes up is like, what happens when an athlete does have a legitimate use of a certain drug that's banned? Or what happens if an athlete, we want to be able to support their health in the pursuit of high performance through using certain supplements that are not, you know, they're kind of outside what the, so there's certain supplements that get this approval that they're allowed to be used, very specific guidelines. So what happens if a supplement, even if it's like pharmaceutical produced or clinically produced by a very good company, what happens if we want a supplement to be used by an athlete, but it's not under that umbrella? Technically, they're breaking the rules or kind of taking the rules into their own hands. So what do we do in those circumstances? And that's a really challenging thing because, in my opinion, that sport is inherently risky for health, the pursuit of high-performance sport. We know that. We know that athletes are, especially like when they're in the height of their competition season, there are certain physiological things that are happening that may not be pro health. They may be kind of pursuing high performance, and at the cost of that is their health. Now, the flip side is with certain substances is that when you open the door up and you say all substances can be used at any dose under any circumstance, we don't really know what that's going to look like in the 21st century because we've never had that. There are examples of things like professional bodybuilding or certain types of strength sport organizations that they don't test for drugs. And we do know that there are people that, again, are the mutant athletes that don't necessarily need to take super physiological doses of things. But then there are also the people that do take super physiological doses of things, and they run into health issues as a result of that. And so there isn't this one size fits all approach. I think that the two worlds can learn a lot from each other if they can think beyond those very rigid criteria that I had spoke to of the, you know, is it healthy? Is it performance enhancement or performance enhancing? And then is it against the spirit of sport? If we can think beyond that, I think we can actually have this more comprehensive discussion that then actually puts the athlete health at the forefront of their pursuit of performance, that we don't have to pick one or the other.
Speaking of athlete health, so much of the conversation that I've seen specifically around the enhanced games has been around athlete safety without any nuance or consideration for men versus women. So I was hoping we could talk a little bit now about some of the short-term and long-term effects that female athletes will have from using performance-enhancing drugs. Because again, I think for the layman, you hear about PEDs, you think big muscles, hypertrophy. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all those kind of the maleness of the performance-enhancing drugs. What are some of the key factors or symptoms or problems that women can have from sustained performance-enhancing drug use?
So number one is what are we talking about when we say performance-enhancing drug? That is a very ambiguous term in my land because there are so many underlying kind of substances that are in that umbrella. If we look at specifically how an organization like the World Anti-Doping Organization defines them, they break them down into specific categories from stimulants to anabolic or muscle building agents to things to support and promote oxygen capacity. So there are many different drugs that fall underneath this umbrella of like PED. And some of those substances are used within medicine every single day. And so that's another important thing to remember. So I think what you're speaking though to is more to our pharmaceutical androgens.
I'm speaking about androgens specifically because of the knock-on effects because of female physiology is obviously very, very different. I think that's, sorry, I should have been clearer in my questioning, but along that line, because of how it can then cause a severe imbalance in the natural female hormone system.
As I sit here with like this disgusting sea of papers around my desk, you know, we don't have a lot of data on this empirically, okay? So number one is, pharmaceutical androgens have been used in clinical settings and non-clinical settings since about the 1930s. That's really when we had that genesis of pharmaceutical androgens. Back then, women did get them prescribed for a host of different medical issues, whether it was for anemia, certain, like I said, muscle wasting disorders, but then also certain gynecological challenges, certain types of cancer. So they were being used broadly. And the, you know, this is that like the dawn of a new era of medicine, right? It's the dawn of the endocrine era, really learning about the endocrine system and hormones and everything else. And so some of those doses were a little crazy, not gonna lie. By today's standards, you look at them and you're like, oof, that poor human. But they were high for both men and women. They didn't know better. They were just creating these drugs. We didn't have randomized controlled trials. We didn't have the same pharmaceutical standards we have today. And so that kind of idea as to what these drugs could potentially do in a female really got exasperated because we kind of saw some dosing getting stretched. There was also, though, what's really important to remember is that androgens, estrogens, and progesterones collectively within both science to this day and historically have been called the sex hormones. And there's this idea that androgens are the male sex hormone and estrogens and progesterone to a lesser extent are the female sex hormones and that they are sex exclusive. So men have one, women have the other. And when we create that idea, what that means is that if we think that androgens are the male sex hormone and they promote things that are associated with maleness, they are not okay in the female body. But that's not true. Women have androgens and a lot of them naturally. We make estrogens from androgens. Our ovaries create them. So even ideas like, oh, well, estrogens and progesterones are the ovarian hormones. It's like, well, actually androgens are too. And just like the testes also create estrogens. So that idea, which, you know, in my land, it's like pre-scientific ideas around these hormones, it was debunked right away. Researchers were like, whoa, 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 whoa. Women have androgens too, varying amounts of them. We were wrong, but it was too late. Names were already applied to it. What does that mean, though, when we start to have this conversation around how do pharmaceutical androgens impact women? Well, there is this expectation that androgens are bad for women, even though they are inherent to their physiology. We have to have them, and not just for our reproductive function, but for our brain health, our neurological health, our bone health. So they have an incredibly important role in our physiology. With anything, though, if we have really low levels on one side or really, really high levels, there's going to be potential implications for that. So the pursuit of giving a female a pharmaceutical androgen often and historically has been to create a hyperandrogenic environment. So an environment within the body that is of high androgens. much higher than they would make on their own. Therefore, there's going to be potential implications for that. Now, it's going to vary individual to individual. There's not a one-size-fits-all because it's a lot more complicated. We have to get into, you know, receptor sensitivity and the balance of other biochemicals. So do they, are they still making sufficient amounts of estrogens? Are they making progesterone? Are they still ovulating? What's their ovarian status? So, you know, if we think of it in that more nuanced way, we can begin to go, okay, it's not one size fits all. These drugs aren't all evils. Androgens aren't unnatural to the female body. But that if we inflate levels to an extremely high, what we call super physiological range, there is a likely chance of there being some potential implications. And what these implications look like are going to vary individual to individual, depending on their reproductive status, their health status, their age of use, their duration of use, their dose, the type of compounds used. So there's a lot of different variables involved. Now, whether we're talking about endogenous or natural levels of androgens, or we're talking about exogenous and pharmaceutical levels of androgens, if we have extremely high levels that are not managed appropriately in a female body, there are potential repercussions for things like ovarian hormone development. So our ovaries are where we make a lot of our hormones and a lot of other biochemicals. But if we have this high level of testosterone, let's say circulating in our bodies, it's going to impact our ovaries' ability to make that hormone and the other necessary ones. There can also be implications for things like our liver function. There can be implications for things like acne and hair loss and mental health and well-being. I mean, really, it's head to toe. There are so many different implications that can occur, whether we're talking about endogenous or exogenous androgens. So the big question that I always have for individuals right now, especially because I think female use, I can't say this is anecdotal because we don't have research to support this, but you know, I've been around the fitness industry a long time. I've been around the sport world a long time. And I can say that in my opinion, we are seeing this higher rate of use, especially within individuals that are younger. So younger women are going on certain types of pharmaceutical androgens for the intent that they're going to provide like muscle building and fat burning capacity. And it's just way more complicated than that. And there are potential long-term implications for that. At the end of the day, Joe, any steroid in abundance is not going to necessarily equate to good health.
So it's really interesting you say that, because I think for a lot of people, myself included, when you think about female athletes taking androgens, my memory, because I'm of that age, goes back to kind of the Soviet bloc, the East German athletes.
East Germans, yeah.
The systemic doping of an entire, you know, Olympic team. And then the horror stories you hear afterwards about the infertility, the mental health issues, all the other things, a generation of elite athletes almost having their life, you know, cut short in many instances. But it's not like that. That is because that was an incredible overuse of these kind of drugs. Whereas what you're saying is, for a lot of people, if you're simply elevating it to the higher ends of natural, there's not those inherent risks. You're probably going to see an awful lot of upside.
Potentially. But the other thing too to remember is that androgens aren't just one thing. There are many different drugs that are underneath that umbrella. In the doping research, in the performance enhancement research, even I would say in the anabolic steroid research, they don't talk about these nuances. And then when we look at things like, you know, like the East German, and of course, that's what I grew up with too. So, you know, my perception of pharmaceutical androgens in women growing up was very like myopic. It was very like limited. It was like, East German's bad. Like that was it. It was like, you don't want to take these things because they're going to be bad. But I got into the research more and I started really looking into it and I started really learning about it and going, okay, well, where did we get these ideas from? What were the actual research underscoring these ideas? What was completed? Who was it done on? Why was it done? And ultimately, there isn't a lot of empirical data on this. A lot of it is, in simplistic sense, after the fact interviews. So where individuals are asked to report on the effects of these drugs for them after they've used them, it doesn't take into consideration what their hormone status was beforehand or afterwards. It doesn't take into consideration what drugs were used, how long they were used for, what the doses were, or even what other variables were involved. You know, if a woman naturally has high levels of androgens circulating in her body, There is also the likelihood, I mean, if we're talking about what we would call polycystic ovarian syndrome or hyper anovulatory androgen excess, so essentially you don't ovulate, which means you don't produce progesterone. If we're talking about that population that already has these high levels of androgens, they already potentially have this high sensitivity to these androgens. Their body's already binding androgens at a greater capacity, and then we add in androgens on top of that, their outcomes are going to look different than somebody who's not in that situation. So it's not, again, I'm neutral. I'm not saying these drugs are terrible for health, but I'm also not saying they're awesome and everybody should run out and take them. That's not the case at all. It's that we always have to contextualize it. We always have to think about what's the drug being used? Who is it being used by? Why is it being used? Under what circumstances? Is it even necessary? I mean, one of the big things I've seen for the last decade is that people gravitate, whether we're talking about men or women, towards performance-enhancing substances when they don't have fundamentals of health down. So they are going, I want to boost my performance. And you go, okay, are you sleeping? Are you eating well? Are you taking care of your mental health? What's your natural hormone production like? When we think about sport, what often gets forgotten is that in certain circumstances, our hormones can be depleted or are castrated. You know, we can castrate our physiological system through high levels of output, low levels of recovery, and high levels of psychosocial stress. So we can shut down our own hormones that way. So if you're doing that, well, maybe the answer is not just replacing them with these drugs that kind of look like they belong in your body, but not really. It doesn't really make sense. And so I just see that there's this complete lack of awareness around, like, what do we need to have in the mix to potentially make it so our performance is optimized? And then from there, what do we need to be able to potentially augment if that's the direction that somebody wants to go? And does that need to be an androgen? Or are there other things that could be put into the mix that may have other benefits without potential risk profiles that are the same? That is just not, that conversation does not get had.
I think, again, for people at my age, it's either the East German female athletes, or the other big event was Ben Johnson in the ATA Seoul Olympics, which was just a worldwide news story. And then up to that point, it had been performance-enhancing drugs were something that was only kind of really associated with athletics. And then obviously you had the Balco scandal, right, where it suddenly just blew the lid off the fact that this was probably happening in almost any professional sport. And the more people I speak to, Victoria, in this, there's almost kind of like a nod and a wink, like everyone's at it, you have to be, you know, performance-enhancing drug industry, if we can call it that, are always going to be one step ahead of WADA or whoever else because of the money involved. Given your unique perspective in the fitness industry, professional sport, and with performance-enhancing drugs, is abuse far more widespread than the average Joe assumes?
We would never know. That's the thing, is that you're not going to disclose that you're doing something if what you're doing could get you, in some countries, arrested. If what you're doing could get you kicked out of your sport, your records taken away. What I can tell you is that I have been privileged enough to work with elite coaches, athletes, and practitioners working with elite athletes in all sectors. So from professional boxing all the way to Olympic level track and field, to your strength sports, your untested federations, even bodybuilders, best women in the world. And that there, what always strikes me is that when a professional athlete or an elite athlete has that, I'm going to call it the it factor, when they have that thing that I don't possess, they honestly don't, and I'm always so shocked, but I've got this one individual I work with, she's the most lovely individual, she's so on top of her training and her recovery and everything else, but she has zero consciousness of supplementation and drugs. Zero. Because she grew up through kind of that WADA sport world. So she always just, they're bad, you don't take them, you don't need them, they're doping. She has zero consciousness, yet she's still one of the best in the world at what she does. So those people exist. And I think when we say, like, all athletes are using drugs, you take that kind of phenotype, that type of athlete, you take their accomplishments and you just literally throw them to the wayside. And that's not fair to do. But it's also not fair to pretend that all athletes, even in tested federations, are playing by the rules, that they are completely, quote, natural athletes. It's also unfair to label drugs as being good or bad when really they're neutral, they're not. So I feel that, like, you know, at the end of the day, there are athletes that, you know, research has, there's some pretty, I gotta say, there's some pretty crazy estimates right now in research of the, like, drug use, certain, like, millions of people. And I'm like, do I think that I'd necessarily agree with that? Maybe not. I want to know where they got those numbers from. They don't actually explain, but it would be great if they could talk about it. If you look at the actual, like, doping kind of levels, they're not astronomically high in organizational sport. What we do need to be concerned about is individuals who are not in organizational sports, that are using substances, because I think that's the bigger question we have to be talking about. That's the bigger issue, and that we, there needs to be more awareness, is that performance enhancing drugs are, you know, they're being used by people in high elite kind of employment worlds, career worlds, to be able to always be awake, never sleep, never be sick, right? So they're using certain substances to enhance their vocational performance. And then you get the individuals that are your everyday gym goer that are also using these substances, and that we have so much attention towards professional sports in terms of testing for drugs and testing athletes and, you know, making sure that they're top notch, that we fail to see that there are many other sectors that are using these drugs that aren't getting that same attention. And that when we think about the adverse risks, that's really who we're seeing them in. It's not necessarily the elite athletes.
I wanted to circle back to something you mentioned earlier about not having the data, but anecdotally noticing a lot more women, particularly young, yeah, going down the performance enhancing drugs route. I was hoping you could shine a little bit of a light on why you think that is. Why are more women turning to performance enhancing drugs?
Yeah, it's fascinating. You know, it's, I can tell you that, so I started training in the gym in about 2004, 2005. And back then, weight training, muscle building was not something you saw young women do, or women of any age do. There was kind of this delineated line in the gym of, you had the women doing cardio, doing their aerobic classes, and then you had men in the weight room. Like, it was such a delineated, there may be that one-off kind of fitness competitor or lifelong athlete that still kind of trained in that sense, but in, like, the everyday gym world, you just didn't see that. Fast forward to today, we have such a beautiful revolution happening where women are going into the gym, where women are wanting to intentionally build muscle through the rigors of nutrition and lifestyle and weight training, and get as strong as they can, and not just for physique purposes, but also for health purposes. We know muscle is the, you know, the organ of longevity, as my good friend and colleague, Dr. Gabrielle Lyon, says, right? It's got an incredibly important physiological purpose in our bodies. And so why wouldn't we want to be able to do activities that support that? Now, because of ideas around sex and gender and kind of just that biologicalness of being a female, there was always that kind of idea that having muscle was not okay for women to possess, you know, and that is a social construction. It's not rooted in biology but at all. And so that, I would say, shifted a ton in the last, especially 10 years, 20 years, but especially last the 10 years or so, in which you do see women being like taking back that idea that I can be strong, I can be muscular, I can, you know, train hard and eat well, and really honing the idea of being a athletic female, no matter what their walk of life is. We just didn't see that 20 years ago the same. I think with that comes also this desire to get there faster through the use of drugs. I think there's also that idea that, and I talked about this kind of at a talk a couple months ago, but education has lagged far behind what we're seeing users and kind of practice doing. So in the world of sport medicine, exercise physiology, but then also conversations around health and performance within kind of more of the professional or practical sector, that's lagged behind. Education is just lagged behind. And so you have individuals that are doing things that we don't have science to support. And it's not that we haven't tried. It's just that it's outpaced. It's completely outpaced by users. And I would argue with the drug use, it's the same thing. I think social media is a big factor too. I think there is this wild thing of unrealistic beauty standards that when I grew up in the 90s, You know, it was the world of photoshopping in magazines. And now it's photoshopping everyday people through the use of apps. Beauty standards have also changed. Oddly enough, I think we actually have made the Kardashians to think for this, but like the idea that it was about big booties, like the big booty era of like 2014 moving forward. So women were going into the gym to try to get this very kind of over the top lower body. And so that beauty standard has shifted. It may shift back. I said to my husband that everything goes around. So we're probably going to go back into the ultra skinny. I'm just waiting for that day to happen. And then we're probably going to have more conversations around eating disorders and low nutrition and the overuse of certain stimulants or agents to help with kind of bigger quotes, but fat loss. That stuff is always moving. So it's just going to be a matter of time until we see the pendulum swing again.
So the primary driver, again, anecdotally, that you're seeing is women want to get not only stronger, but actually want put on lean muscle mass. That's your experience. Like, again, I find that so fascinating for a number of reasons, but I think the education is what I want to focus on, because for a young guy going in and supplementing their testosterone or whatever, they're going to see the results, and maybe if they're relatively sensible, there's not going to be a ton of long-term negative implications. But my concern would be for women not having the education behind it, is it would be very easy to suddenly be taking on too much of these compounds that then can have not only severe health implications, but potentially irreversible ones as well. Is there an education piece missing here? Are you worried about these young people?
Yeah, absolutely.
And taking it and then not realizing what they might have gotten some muscle in the first 3 months, but what are they going to look like in 3 years?
Yeah, and I see this a lot. So in 2016, I got the opportunity to speak at a big sport medicine conference, really big one. And it was really one of the first times that a female stood up, female academic stood up and was like, hey, we need to start talking about this. Cause I saw it starting. I was training every day in a commercial gym in like a residential area, and I was seeing more women use starting. And it was an incredibly important conversation that we had back then that I kind of started, and I just have been continuing to have it, because I think it is, we don't have the education. There is this huge kind of binary that we create in terms of these are the worst things ever, women should never take them, or they're not that big of a deal, not a problem. And it's just way more complicated than that. Like I said, we have to talk more about what their health status is before using. We have to talk about their age. We have to look at their reproductive history, their health history, their duration of use. Like, there are so many nuances involved that just are completely getting lost in this good versus bad kind of dichotomy that's created. I'm more scared today than I was a decade ago around female use. Even with more educators going out and speaking to this, it's not enough. There's always going to
be the proliferation, because more and more young women are doing it.
So my concern, like, more women are using, we don't have education within the medical sector about it. We don't have education within the kind of more wellness fitness sector about it. What we do have, I see a lot. I try not to pay attention to it because I like to see what people are saying, but I get so frustrated when I see sometimes some of the ideas promoted, and then I just go, okay, that just means I got to put my head down and work harder to get the better understanding, the better words out there. But the idea that it's okay for young girls to take, let's say, testosterone replacement therapy, that's not benign. Even if it's testosterone, which our bodies make, so the molecule of testosterone and, let's say, an injectable ester, certain types, is going to look similar to what our bodies make. But at 22, who already has let's say abnormal menstrual cycles, is already on an oral contraceptive agent that's having an anti-androgenic effect, because some of the oral contraceptives do it. If they take that, is it okay? I don't have the data, but I can tell you from like the biochemical world and the physiological world, probably not. But unfortunately, you have promoters and individuals saying that it is okay. And that's what scares me, because there are people in powerful positions that have hundreds of thousands of followers on social media that are going like, no, it's fine. It's biological. It's okay. And, you know, a little goes a long way. And it's like, no. It's way more complicated than that. The human body, whether we're talking about men or women, is incredibly complex, interdynamic network of molecules and systems, past and present. And that in the female reproductive system, hormones are always changing, right? We have our ovarian hormone production. It is an incredibly complex physiological cascade that occurs, and it is very sensitive to the use of certain biochemicals or the certain kind of injection of drugs into the system, whether we're talking about thyroid hormone when it's not needed, whether we're talking about androgens when it's not needed, whether we're talking about kind of the stacking of multiple different things when it's not needed. And I'm not saying that women shouldn't do that, but they need to ask questions about it. They need to really think about what is being promoted, why it's being promoted and by who. They need to think about what's involved for them to be able to potentially do this safer or healthier if that's the direction that they want to go. They need to really kind of dial in and go, do I have my foundations in place first? Like, does using this substance make sense for me today? If I'm a 22-year-old female that just started lifting, I don't have my nutrition on point. I'm not sleeping. I'm still drinking alcohol. I'm on a hormonal contraceptive that's have high amounts of synthetic estradiol, or so ethanol estradiol, and an anti-androgenic progesterone. Does that make sense then to throw an anabolic steroid in the mix? Probably not. I can't say.
Mm-hmm. I'm just amazed because just again, my naivety thinking that a 22-year-old young woman would be considering this kind of.
Yeah.
Again, I'm not in that particular world on social media. I'm not following those type of accounts. So, but the information is out there, Victoria. It doesn't take long to go to a search engine and find out what the side effects were. So is this young woman? Well, I'll let you answer. I'll finish my question in case it helps you out. Is this young women ignoring the information out there, thinking, well, I trust this influencer more, or is it genuine that they don't understand what they're doing? Because I think there's quite an important distinction there, which would be more encouraging to you putting information out there if you felt that it was just a vacuum gap. But if it's women choosing to ignore the warnings because the short-term gains are more attractive to them, that's a completely different battle, isn't it?
Yeah, so I think it's a few different things happening here. So, okay. Let me take a breath here. So, again, I can't say this is everybody, but this is what I'm seeing. I'm seeing certain downplaying of potential physiological implications of use. Though I don't call, let's say, hair growth, facial hair growth or acne, I don't call those side effects of androgens. I call them effects. They're unintended effects. You just want the muscle building potential. You don't want all the other baggage that comes with it. You don't want, you know, micro or chronic inflammation. You don't want anovulatory menstrual cycles. You don't want that. But let me tell you, if depending on the user, the duration of use, the drug being used, that can happen. They're not the intended ones you want. And so high levels of androgens in many individuals are not benign, whether we're talking about men or women, that they have to be monitored. And unfortunately, there's this kind of discussion that I see in the fitness industry right now, where there's this downplaying of risk, because, you know, the risks have been hyperinflated. That's the thing, is that they're, especially with like anabolics, like they've been so hyperinflated by the politic kind of community, the scientific community, the medical community, that you have this like absolute opposite effect happening where it's like, don't listen to them. It's wrong. If you Google them, they're not telling you the truth. They're suppressing you. They are keeping you down and not letting you be optimal. And it's like, whoa, not quite. Neither of the camps are really, you know, thinking through this carefully and critically. So that's number one thing I see, is I see experts that are kind of promoting this idea that risks are hyperinflated. Number two is I see experts that are taking discussions of certain pharmaceutical androgens and putting them not in context. So they're looking at a specific study, let's say that's been done on individuals that are transitioning, so F to M, or within geriatric populations, chronically ill populations, but women, and applying those results to your 22-year-olds and being like, well, this is what this study found. And it's just like, no, it's way more complicated than that. So I see that happening. So they kind of have this guise of science behind them that this is what the research is saying. And the reality is that, yeah, the research is saying that, but it's not for that population. It's not for that drug. So I'm seeing kind of these overinflation of scientific studies that may not be totally backed by solid, time-tested empirical data. And then I'm seeing individuals that are going to certain types of, like, if I were just to Google, let's say, like, female steroid cycle, they're going to some of the websites that pop up without recognizing that who's making this information are the people manufacturing the drugs. And so now you're getting this, like, really grossly made information that's not necessarily a, I don't want to say accurate portrayal, but maybe a fully encompassing portrayal of how these drugs are going to interact with you. And just like many uses of drugs, where they're talking about pharmaceutical or lifestyle recreationals, that people don't put it in context. So the conversation about, like, how does this information apply to me? You know, is there more risks for a 22-year-old than there is for a 35-year-old? Is there more risks for somebody who is on other types of medications, or that have certain types of health histories, or that have certain types of future health goals? Let's say they want to be able to conceive in the next 3 to 5 years. There's that piece of actually thinking through use that's not happening. And then I also see the under, again, big air quotes, but experts in this field that are kind of looking at this in this very limited, myopic way of going, like, these drugs are good, women should be able to take them, freedom of choice, don't let people suppress you kind of attitude. When they do that, they're not actually thinking about the implications of their words. They're thinking about followers, not implications of what their words are actually saying. And that's scary. That is a really scary thing. As somebody who prides themselves in doing really solid research that's not only theoretical, but empirical based, it is scary to see that happening, because the platform is given often to those who have the biggest following, not who should have the biggest following. And I think in this conversation, that's what I see. And that happens with everything, though, Joe. It's when, you know, people going, this is the one exercise you should be doing. And
I completely get that. And, you know, I've been in the industry probably almost as long as you. And I you know, nutrition is the one thing you see it around. And people absolutely swear blind to one dietary approach over another. But that's all being well. You know, try doing carnivore, try doing keto. If it doesn't work for you, no harm done. With something like this that could have, you know, like I said, irreversible health implications. Mm-hmm. And young women are making a decision to take performance-enhancing drugs based on zero information or falsified information. So, you know, you are a world-renowned expert in women's training and women's health. What are the big rocks? If a young girl's listening to this and is new to the gym and new to training and wants to put on some muscle size or get stronger, what are the things she should be focusing on first before performance-enhancing drugs are even on her radar?
The best way to build muscle is to train hard, train intentional, meaning it's not just going to the gym and being like, I'm going to go to failure on every single exercise. So it's training hard, it's training intentional, and then it's having foundations or pillars of not only recovery in place, but things to support your training. So nutrition, sleep, positive social relationships. Those are all the things, and again, so many other kind of things in our toolbox. So there are so many of those fundamental aspects that don't get put into place before people pursue the drug route. They perceive that the drug route is a quick fix. It's going to get them there faster. And of course that, you know, so-and-so on social media said that there's no side effects, so no harm done. So that would be number one, is that, like, we really need to think through, like, are we training hard enough to create the intended result? And smart enough to create the intended result. I can tell you, like, I was an idiot back in, like, my early training days, where I was overtraining, under-eating, and I didn't have these things in place. And I had health consequences as a result. And that doesn't always get talked about. So unfortunately, I'm kind of labeled drugs to be this end-all, be-all bad thing for women's health, when the reality is that, yeah, overtraining, under-eating, chronic poor recovery is not good for health short-term and long-term. And for some individuals, they can get through it. Other individuals, there could be long-term effects of them. So that would be the first thing. The second thing is that women's health is, I mean, it is as bad as the fitness industry in terms of camps of information, pseudoscience, myths, misunderstandings, practitioners that are bound by research that may not be the best examples of scientific rigor. And so when women go to their doctors, when women ask, say, if I were to say, like, okay, well, if you're thinking about going on, you know, X substance, you should go and get a health check first. Well, for let's use that example again, for a 22-year-old female to go in and request a physical, That is a hard thing to do as a female. There are so many barriers to good healthcare for women that are still systemic. Like, they're still everywhere. We see them. We see women that have, let's say, abnormal uterine bleeding, getting the only solution that they get provided is to go on an oral contraceptive pill. And that's not to say that that may not be an effective way to overcome this, but it's not the only thing we should be talking about. It's not the only thing that practitioners should be providing. And I say this as a researcher looking at the research longitudinal, so across time, and also critically looking at all the different studies. I mean, when I talk about like my doctoral work, it's like, it's taken 7-8 years, because if you do it dense and if you do it deep and you really ask the questions on every single example, it takes time to do it. And that's when you can really start to see like where these ideas come from and how they impact individuals on a one-on-one basis, whether we're talking about how medical practitioners like create information or how users themselves understand it. So I would say that a big thing is that we just don't have that conversation about what it means to train hard for, let's say, hypertrophy or for health for women. And what does it mean to be able to help women be as healthy as possible and have a practitioner support them in that without feeding into myths and misconceptions around what it means to be a biological female. So that as a result, if women do even go on use, they're often not able to get the care they need from a medical practitioner to help them get to a better health state after they've used this compound.
When it comes to training for hypertrophy, are there any significant protocol differences required between men and women? The reason I asked that is I interviewed Dr. Stacey Sims, and she was talking around different nutrition protocols. Women should do faster training, for instance, or post-exercise ice bath or cold water immersion, the physiological differences between men and women. On the gym floor, in the weights room, are there significant things that women should be doing differently to elicit the same hypertrophy response, or is it pretty much what works for men will work for women when it comes to muscle building?
It's one size. That's the thing. Human beings are so incredibly different, and who I am today is not going to be who I am tomorrow or the next day. So I challenge some of the research that takes these really hard stances that say women should be doing X and men should be doing Y. You know, we know from sex-based and gender-based research that the differences between biological men and women are actually a lot less than we think that they are. And the differences within groups, so the differences among biological women, are actually far greater than we perceive them to be. And that's not me just saying that as like, you know, based on my background. That's me looking at lots of different research that's come up with that, whether we're talking about like neurosciences to physiology to pharmacokinetics, that they're there are important differences between the sexes, but are they as big as we perceive them to be? And then when we talk about women, we homogenize that. All women should be doing this. And it's like, no. The diversity of women is massive. The individual factors beyond just reproductive function are massive. And so I really feel that what we have to promote in individuals is something that will help them create a sustainable and positive life change. So if that's training, it's how do we create a sustainable plan that is going to be tailored to that person, to what they're interested in, to what we know is going to be necessary for the end goal, whether it's a health goal, performance goal, or a combination of both. And how do we do this in a way that fits them to a T and recognize that it's humans are fluid. We're not static creatures. We're not, I'm not going to train the same as another individual that's age matched for me and even maybe has a similar athletic background to me. What works for me today in this kind of era of my life is very different than what worked for me 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And it's going to look different 5 years from now. Even I would say 6 months from now, it's likely going to look different, right? We don't talk about things like training age or athletic background and how that may impact an individual's ability to build muscle. We don't talk about underlying physiological health status, especially for women. It's so anchored in just reproductive function. Like, what are their hormones doing? What's their menstrual cycle status doing? That we don't talk about, hey, well, what actually is like their response to, let's say, glucose? What is their ability and affinity to be able to buffer against cellular stress? Those things get lost when we focus so much on training specific women, hormones, menstrual cycle. And that those things matter. They're very important to the muscle building equation. So I guess I counter it in going that, like, I see women training all different ways. I see women eating all different ways. Is there a one size fits all? No. Are there certain things that we can say with a relative degree of certainty may not be advantageous for long-term health, short-term performance? Absolutely. You know, if somebody is in a chronic caloric deficit with high amounts of training stimulus all the time, that probably is not going to have positive outcomes for them. You know, with the idea of fasting, do we know that women's kind of hypothalamic reproductive axes, the, you know, the nervous system, hypothalamus, the pituitary, the ovaries, that's very sensitive to physiological stressors and psychological stressors. And we know that nutrition is an incredibly important anchor that helps with our rhythmic production of hormones. So do we want to be doing things that are going to interrupt that? Probably not. But are there certain individuals that, let's say, the only time they have to train is at 4:30 in the morning because they have three kids, a full-time job, and a side hustle, and it's either there or some other time? And is it fair for me then to be like, you cannot do this, it's terrible for you? No, no, it's my job to try to figure out a solution. Try to figure out something that is a middle ground that may not be perfect, lesser evils of sorts. And that doesn't mean that I'm going to say, like, gold stamp, yes, you can fast. No, it's going to mean that we're going to work on it. We're going to figure out a solution. I think that these hard fast rules can leave a lot of women feeling helpless. It can leave a lot of women feeling like alienated, unsure. And so we need to just be really careful with how we express science, practice, personal opinion, so on. It's got to always come back to the individual and really center on them.
I think the perfect storm of all those things you just mentioned has been illuminated recently in transgender sport, right? And it's been very much portrayed as a black and white issue, that if you are transitioning and have gone through a male puberty and then transitioning to a woman, you have an unfair advantage over biological women because of the impact of testosterone. It's incredibly confusing for a lot of people who aren't immersed in the science to actually understand what is going on here. I was really hoping you could give, if you're okay, just to give an overview of, is testosterone having a massive impact on performance? I spoke to Dr. Carol Hooven about the behavioral impacts of testosterone and how even in the embryo, it's making changes to your brain. So it seems very, very clear that the science is there for how it dictates behavior. But what about performance? Am I right in saying that testosterone does have a huge impact?
You're going to hate my answer here.
I'm genuinely interested.
So I can't say for certain either way.
Okay.
Right? Because it's not causal per se. Like, people are going to be like, oh, yes, it is. But it's like, no, 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 hold on, per se. And I'm not, you know, I know a lot about this. I am not the expert in this. I can, you know, there's as I've got this massive pile on my desk, there's a lot of great resources. This book is fantastic. And there's an entire chapter on testosterone and athleticism from a critical basis. They look at the research on it. So, yes, steroid hormones, whether we're talking about androgens, estrogens, progesterone, have a physiological effect on multicellular processes. Absolutely. From, you know, when we are in utero all the way to, you know, walking earth side, they have a physiological impact. However, that impact varies individual to individual. We have to think about receptors. We have to think about transportation. We have to think about metabolism. We have to think about the blend or the harmony between other steroid hormones, between other biochemicals, between other epigenetic and genetic aspects. There are so many things involved. And so I can't say for certain, because I don't believe that the research right now is as clear cut as we have kind of understood it to be. Androgen deprivation may have impacts for that individual, not just for androgens. So what I mean by that is that when we have an androgen withdrawal in somebody, when we stop them from producing it, and we actually give them something to stop them from binding at the androgen receptor, the kind of secondary androgens that they're creating from their adrenal glands, that there can be other impacts that arise from that, influencing how they utilize and make, let's say, IGF-1, how that they impact and utilize their thyroid function, how they are retaining nitrogen in the mouth. Like, there's so many different physiological effects that are happening. And so now we have to look at all of those as well in an individual to see what those systems were like before and after androgen deprivation. So I just think that we have a lot more to move with that research. I think that we forget that estrogens have an incredibly important role for athletic performance and physiology, if I use that just as a dichotomy, as an example. And if we are removing androgens and we're now giving somebody estrogens as well, that that is going to potentially have alternate influences on their health and performance that that research isn't necessarily looking at. So I just don't know if we have clear-cut basis. I'm not going to sit here and say that if an individual takes an androgen, they're not going to have any performance impacts. That's not what I'm saying at all. It's just that they're going to be varied and they're going to be nuanced. And that they're
certainly,
all...
it certainly feels as though the kind of the blanket argument that if somebody does transition and is given testosterone, they've inherently got an advantage over biologically born women. But you're saying the science doesn't support that. It's not, you cannot make that claim because of individual nuance.
Well, some of the science will say that. And that's the thing. That's where so as a critical researcher, it's like I look at science and I look at where ideas get created from. What's the foundational knowledge, the mechanisms involved? What are we looking at? And how is that getting translated into scientific research and then into scientific findings? And what we see with testosterone is that there is a heck of a lot of social ideas that have been embedded in how we perceive and understand the physiology of testosterone in both male and female or biological men and women's bodies. And that there are a huge amount of kind of myths and myths perceptions around it that have really infiltrated every single aspect of that research journey, from, you know, creating an experiment to actually doing it, to how users feel and how they report findings. And that we have to really consider that, because if we've called this hormone a sex hormone and we've associated it with athletic performance since like actually before we even knew what testosterone was, like back in like 1840s, that will have implications for how we study and how we understand it. If I look just at the surface level of some of the research, there are, I would say, a mixed bag of findings. I do think it comes down to the individual in hand. I think also it comes down to the duration of use of withdrawal. It comes down to what hormones are being added in on top of. I think it also comes down to that individual's it factor. So what's the thing that drives them to be an amazing performer in the first place? The reason why I say this is that androgens aren't, like, again, there's a lot of different types of androgens. And so with the hyperandrogenism ruling in sport, and I don't know if you know about this, but about in 2010-ish, the International Athletics Federation, they introduced this rule saying that if women's testosterone levels naturally were above a certain threshold, that they had to either withdraw from sport or take certain substances to reduce it. There was a huge battle that came after that of people going like, wait a second here. If a woman's ovaries are creating more androgens and they're also creating more estrogens and progesterones, why are we just assuming that it's going to have an automatic impact on performance? Because what they found is that it wasn't the basis. And that the research that was done by the sporting organizations wasn't really empirically grounded. I mean, they even had people that were known to be dopers in the data mix. So people that they knew were taking androgens that were eliciting a very particular biochemical outcome for athletic performance into that. And so they're going, wait a second here, like this doesn't seem right. So, you know, the organization kept reworking the rules. And as of like 2019, the rules were that if you had this kind of what they called an inborn physiological state that increased androgen production, that you would still have to take a hormonal contraceptive to reduce the activity of androgen in a woman's body, regardless of what the scientific research had shown in that population. So the science on this world, the understanding, the rhetoric is so complicated and twisted, because androgens aren't all the same and how they work in individual bodies aren't all the same. And there are individuals that we know when they go under androgen deprivation that they may be able to maintain a certain level of performance to a point, but they also may not. We don't have, I think, clear enough research to support it yet.
I'm going to ask you another million-dollar question. I think it might be the third one, right? And sorry for putting you on the spot here, but what is the solution until we have the science then? Because I spoke to former British Olympic swimmer Sharon Davis, who believes that there should be an open category. You've got biological men, biological women, and open, because that is the only way of ensuring fairness for all. What's your stand on that for elite sport?
Yeah, so I actually used to teach a class on this, I used to pose this to my students, and I used to always say, like, it's not for me to decide.
today it is.
yeah, it's not. But I don't disagree with that. So, you know, when we look at, let's say, Paralympic sport, what we see is we see a bunch of different categories for performing. We see a huge amount of almost like micro classification of the body, you know, single amputee, double amputee with apparatus. There are so many different categories and breakdowns. Sport was built on binary thinking. Sport was built, I mean, initially women were not allowed to participate in sport, right? Because of social perceptions around women's bodies and inferiority and just the kind of the eternally wounded woman, that we were not strong enough to be able to do it. So, you know, women's bodies have had a lot of stigma surrounding them. Female athletic bodies have had a lot of stigma surrounding them. And women have had to work damn hard to get where we are today to even have some semblance of equality. And I would argue that we're still not there at all. So with that said, there are physiology in terms of sex and gender is incredibly complex. It's not and or. It's not black or white. There are shades and variances there. And that there has been a huge, beautiful body of research that's showing that even something like anatomical sex difference is not black or white. That you have individuals that are variables. You have individuals that have variances of different kind of even, let's say, genitals. That they're not just A or B. It's very fluid. I think hormones are the same thing. We have individuals that are at all ends of these spectrums. So I don't disagree with that idea of having an open category for now, if that's the potential solution forward. I can sound probably like a complete like asshole when I say this, but if we want to play, like if I'm coming in to play your game and you set the rules and I want to play in your game, then I am going to essentially follow the rules that you're set because I want to play that role. Now, problem with right now with high performance sport is that who are setting the rules aren't necessarily doing them the most fair, the most ethical, backed by, you know, very altruistic ideas. Like that's not happening at all. And so that I think is one of the rhetorics that we see existing right now where people go like, well, you know, you either just, you compete or you don't. It's simple, right? You got to play by the rules. And it's like, well, no, actually, you know, the powers that be have an immense amount of power and there's not any overseeing bodies. And so when they do make errors in, you know, let's say sex testing in sport and the history of that, we know that it was incredibly unethical. There was a lot of injustices done that were absolutely heinous and that they shouldn't have happened. And so we do need to have whistleblowers. We do need to have people like these checks and balances that exist. The open category could be a potential way to overcome that. But I truly feel that whenever we have a high emotion situation, something that we've invested a lot of time and money and energy into it, that there are always going to be strong opinions surrounding what's right and what's wrong. And whether we're talking about trans athletes or the you know, dope-only games, drug testing, right? There's always going to be these strong opinions. There, even if you can like do the most rigorous policy making process that try to be as inclusive as possible, there are still going to be people that are going to criticize it and challenge it. Ultimately, I can tell you that like this is, I think, the nice kind of like come around of the topics we've discussed, that sex and drugs in sport are inextricably linked. They are tangled so tight together, and they have been since the beginning. And that it, as somebody, you know, as a researcher in this world in 2024, I would say that it's getting a lot more complicated with more research that's coming out, with more people participating in sport, with more and kind of diversity of ideas or surrounding drug use and sex and gender and everything else. And that, so for the people that are making those policies, is that I want to hope that they're taking into consideration all of these different variables and they will do the right thing, whatever that looks like, but that's going to continually be changing over time.
Final question. It feels to me that with performance-enhancing drugs, SARMs, peptides, nutritional supplements, the line's kind of blurring between what was very clearly before a performance-enhancing drug and maybe what was just classified as a health supplement. Yeah. With that, do you agree, firstly, that that line is blurring? And also, if so, do you think that's a positive thing for you, for your educational piece? Because if more people are aware of these things, does it make them more receptive to information?
It's funny you ask that because I have been trying to write about that for about 2 weeks now. Yeah, and it is, it's really complicated, right? Because the blurred line, I would say the lines have always been blurred, especially when we're talking about androgens and testosterone and kind of that umbrella, is that they have been used for health purposes since, they were first created in the 1930s, synthesized, but they've also been always associated with kind of non-health uses too. They were associated from like vitality and anti-aging from before we even synthesized testosterone. So there's always these dualities, these are multiplicities actually surrounding drugs and how we perceive them. One drug, let's say pharmaceutical testosterone, can have multiple different identities surrounding it. It can be used in so many different settings, whether we're talking about recreational use or performance use or performance enhancement use or health or longevity, anti-aging. There are so many different identities that we attach and associate to it. So I would argue that the lines have always been blurry, that we just have more of a consciousness now surrounding them in the current day, and that it is a conversation that is evolving very, very fast, in my opinion. We don't necessarily see as much awareness around it, especially like in the academic literature, it's growing. But I would say that on the front lines of social media and YouTube, there are a lot of people that have a lot more to say about it, about the multiplicity, the blurriness, the fuzziness around it. And that I think really, I really truly think we're continuing to see that change. It's going to always be evolving, and you're always going to have people that have really strong opinions about like how to identify a drug, classify it, use it, who should be using it, who shouldn't be using it. There is always going to be those stronger rules because of what it is. There's policy surrounding it. There's regulations surrounding it. And so there are hard, fast decisions that have to get made when we look at policy. If policy surrounding drugs didn't exist, I would be a little scared because then all of a sudden, we don't have the same standards for practicing the production of them. We don't have the same standards about prescribing them. We don't have the same standards for the pricing of that people pay for them. So it's not that policy surrounding drugs are bad. They do have to take a hard stance role at some point, and it's just, is that the one that they've taken the right one?
Your area of expertise is almost by far the most complex I've ever had to deal with a health and fitness journalist. Do you ever wish you'd chosen something a little bit more black and white, or is this what you live for?
Every dang day. But here's the thing is curiosity, I came about as a exercise physiology student. Like I came about in this world that was a lot more mono paradigm, single theoretical background and perspective. Research was conducted in a certain way, these, very, very streamlined way. That was the path I was on. Through more academic exposure, through personal experience, through being within my own health challenges, through my own experiences as a female muscle building person in a time that muscle building wasn't a thing, my perspectives and understanding got challenged. And as a very curious person, I was like, well, why? Like, what is it about this? And then all of a sudden I went from being this very kind of scientific path to multidisciplinary. And the pendulum swung into the social sciences and the humanities because I was like, well, I want to know why we have these ideas. Like if there's a rule regulating a drug, I want to know where that came from. Because it didn't just come down out of the sky, or if there's a certain theory about how a hormone works in the body. It's not like somebody just waved a wand and it appeared in this textbook. Like, what were the ideas surrounding it? Where did they come from? Who was involved? How did they move through time and change and shift? And so I wouldn't ever change this perspective. I understand it needs to become with, like my husband says, like a warning label, because it's hard for me to always give this like single answer to things because unfortunately or fortunately, the world we live in is not that simple. We just want it to be. We try to make it that way. And it is incredibly complex. And I don't think you can pick a more challenging subject based off of my research than when we talk about sex and drugs, especially sex drugs. That's even more complicated. And that when, it, like with my actual research, I though every day I'm like, why did I do this? Like, why did I make this so much harder on myself? And the answer is that I did what I thought was right to do from a research back. My ethical compass when it comes to research is really strong, and I didn't ever want to produce something that I felt like was not paying tribute to the complexity of what the picture is.
Thank you for listening to the Unfiltered podcast. If you've got this far, I hope you won't mind if I ask you to leave a 5-star review when you get the chance. We'd really appreciate it. And don't forget, you can access all of our exclusive Unfiltered video interviews and features at unfilteredonline.com and the Unfiltered Extra YouTube channel. See you next time.